come now to our 4:15 study here at the Arkansas Camp 1980 on Monday afternoon. And this brings us to number 5 in our series thus far in the study of the book of Daniel, the prophet. We come to the place where Daniel has been collected for execution. Just a bit more. And although completely undeserving, he was about to be taken off and put to death along with the rest of the wise men of Babylon. It's a strange thing that in the first instance, the king did recognize a distinction between Daniel and the rest of the magicians, and because of that, was not prepared to call him to interpret the dream. But when the decree went forth to slay the wise men of Babylon, that distinction was waived, and now Daniel was regarded as simply being a part of the general company of the magicians, with the result that with this, now that the lack of distinction was not there, he was about to be slain. Now, of course, this is what we call expediency. And it's a characteristic of Babylon that they will do things not because they're right, but because they're expedient. And it was very expedient on the part of the Babylonian power to have this nice excuse to get rid of forever Daniel, Meshach, Shadrach, and Abednego. Now, justice, impartial justice would have said, well, it was good enough to leave Daniel out when we needed counsel, it therefore has to be good enough to leave him out when it comes to execution. After all, what has he done that merits this capital punishment? The Babylon being Babylon, inconsistency marking her ways, then of course, this is exactly what you'd expect that great power to do so far as the man of God was concerned. And so Daniel was gathered in to the dragnet to be slain with the rest of the wise men of Babylon. Now, this was exactly according to God's plan. God knew perfectly well that when King Nebuchadnezzar was confronted with a mystery, the unexplained dream, God knew he'd call the wise men and the magicians. When they couldn't explain the dream, God knew that King Nebuchadnezzar would commission their death. God knew perfectly well that Satan would seize upon this as the opportunity to destroy God's people, the church in Babylon. And then God recognized that this would be the opportunity then to bring Daniel in before King Nebuchadnezzar. Now, the coming in of Daniel before King Nebuchadnezzar was an entrance or a movement that was fraught with the greatest danger. Now, bear in mind that King Nebuchadnezzar was absolutely furious. He was in no mild mood whatsoever. And in that state of mind, he was not apt to be very reasonable or logical, but would just as soon give the command, take off his head, as anything else. Now, if Daniel had presumptuously gone before the king, after a plan which he'd made himself, he would have died that day, I do believe. I really believe he would have died that day. But when God's plan took him in there, then what hope did Daniel have of dying? None at all. He had perfect and complete protection. And it is a very great comfort to us to know that we are where God has directed us to be at a given point of time, because if you are where God has put you, and He is your perfect plan maker in all things, then you are absolutely immortal until your work is done. When your work is done, of course, then that's another story, or maybe another story as the case may be. So then, here we find Daniel in before the king. Let's read the verses 14 and on to verse 18. Then Daniel answered with counsel and wisdom to Arioch, the captain of the king's guard, which was gone forth to slay the wise men of Babylon. He answered and said to Arioch, the king's captain, why is the decree so hasty from the king? And Arioch made the thing known to Daniel. Then Daniel went in and desired of the king that he would give him time, and that he would show the king the interpretation. Then Daniel went to his house and made the thing known to Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, his companions, that they would desire mercies of the God of heaven concerning the secret, that Daniel and his fellows should not perish with the rest of the wise men of Babylon. I am quite interested to notice that the king charged the wise men as seeking to gain time. And the king said, I will not give you time. Under any circumstances you shall not be given time. Daniel goes to the king and says, give me time. What's the king say? Okay, you can have time. Now, what made the difference? What alone could make the difference? The mighty influence of the Spirit of God upon the heart of that angry king. leading him to grant the reasonable request that Daniel required. And of course, the king in the presence of Daniel was in the presence of the Spirit of God, because the mighty Spirit of God was in Daniel. And as Daniel stood there calm, fearless, noble, and pure before that king, the king was very, very deeply impressed and mightily influenced by the power that was in the prophet of God. Now Daniel made no attempt to make known the dream or the interpretation out of his own head. He went away in the time he required, of course, so he could kneel down before the God of heaven, whom he absolutely recognized to be his source. And from that source, and that source alone, he hoped, I beg your pardon, he knew that God would give to him the dream and the interpretation thereof. We'll turn back now to a statement in the Bible commentary on the book of Daniel. It's volume 4, page 1170, and reads as follows. In Daniel's life, the desire to glorify God was the most powerful of all motives. He realized that when standing in the presence of men of influence, a failure to acknowledge God as the source of his wisdom would have made him an unfaithful steward. And his constant recognition of the God of heaven before kings, princes and statesmen detracted not one iota from his influence. The statement comes originally from the Review and Herald of January 11, 1906. Now it says here that Daniel recognized that a failure to acknowledge God as a source of his wisdom. So Daniel was very, very conscious of the fact and ever witness to the fact that God was his source. Now comes the wonderful prayer of praise that Daniel uttered in verses 19 to 23. Then was the secret revealed unto Daniel in a night vision. Then Daniel blessed the God of heaven. Daniel answered and said, Blessed be the name of God for ever and ever, for wisdom and might are his. And he changeth the times and seasons. He removeth kings and setteth up kings. He giveth wisdom unto the wise and knowledge to them that know understanding. He revealeth the deep and secret things. He knoweth what is in the darkness, and the light dwelleth with him. I thank thee and praise thee, O thou God of my fathers, who hast given me wisdom and might, and hath made known unto me now what we desired of thee, for thou hast now made known unto us the king's matter. To whom alone did Daniel give all the credit for the revelation of this dream? Right, to God and God alone. And in that continued attitude in his part is the secret of Daniel's unfailing success. I said this morning, whatever those of us who are in this movement unfailingly recognize Christ alone as the true head of this church, as the plan maker, director, problem solver, there is no possibility of this group failing. But when that time, should that time come, let's never say when, let's say should that time come, and pray God it never does, that any of us in this church begin to exalt ourselves as human heads, either over ourselves or over other members of the church, and in that day, this movement begins to fail. And most likely will never recover, because in the past we never found a movement yet that turned aside from God's plans that ever recovered thereafter. From that point on, they just went downhill and downhill and downhill to utter and complete failure. But the whole of Daniel's life from beginning to end was marked by a consistent and persistent faithfulness in recognizing himself as but a dependent receiver and God as an all-sufficient source. And Christ in between, of course, as the great connector. And because of that, we don't find one sin, one shortcoming, one mistake written against the prophet Daniel, but all the way through, he is ever and only a great man of God who knew only success and victory in every encounter with the prince of darkness. And now verse 24 and on. Therefore Daniel went in unto Arioch, whom the wise men had ordained to destroy the wise men of Babylon. He went and said thus unto him, Destroy not the wise men of Babylon. Bring me in before the king, and I will show unto the king the interpretation. Now I really admire the character of Daniel, because he had to recognize that the wise men of Babylon were the enemies of God's truth. And it's a very, very strong indication given to us in the next chapter. chapter 3, that at least some of those wise men who were saved by Daniel on this occasion took the opportunity to report them to King Nebuchadnezzar, that is Meshach, Shadrach, and Abednego, and thus, if possible, to bring about their destruction in the burning fiery furnace. Now, I can't absolutely prove this, but it certainly looks as if those same wise men and Daniel saved turned around later and bit the hand that fed them, so to speak. Now, Daniel could easily have said to Ariel, do what you like with those wise men, they don't belong to my category. The king has given the command to destroy them, so you'd best go ahead and destroy them. Daniel could have said that. But instead, Daniel said to Ariel, no, he said, don't do that. Don't slay them, because a secret has been found, and therefore they do not need to die. And so, of course, the fate of those wise men was reversed, and they didn't go to their deaths on that particular day. Now, we come to verse 25, and God's plan is advancing along very, very nicely. And here we find that Arioch brought in Daniel before the king in haste and said thus unto him, I have found a man of the captives of Judah that will make known unto the king the interpretation. Now, Arioch said, I have found a man. Now, what was Arioch? Right, he was a Babylonian. Not just by birth alone, but by practice and by principle, or lack of principle, as the case may be. Because this man was, first of all, a liar. He had not found Daniel. Two, he was placing himself in God's place, because it was God that put Daniel right in that position. It was God who directed the ways of Daniel. It was God who was bringing Daniel in before King Nebuchadnezzar. And so, therefore, Arioch was taking glory to himself that did not belong, and a position to himself which was replacing God with himself. And therefore, he was, in every sense of the word, a real Babylonian. Very much so. Now, in verse 26, we find that Satan has not given up the struggle. And so King Nebuchadnezzar personally, before the dream is given, King Nebuchadnezzar personally invites Daniel to join the ranks of Babylon. Now read the verse, and let's see if we can see in what way King Nebuchadnezzar made this invitation. Verse 26, the king answered and said to Daniel, whose name was Belteshazzar, art thou able to make known unto me the dream which I have seen in the interpretation thereof? Now, what would have been the very most natural response for a man to have made, and what would certainly have been a Babylonian's response? Yes, I am able to tell the king the interpretation, the dream rather, and the interpretation thereof. I can do it. Now, Daniel had, on that occasion, fallen for that enticing temptation that he would have joined the ranks of Babylon. He still could have interpreted the dream, but I don't believe he would have given the interpretation God gave to him if he'd made that kind of step. He just simply would not have had the courage to do so. Now, when God opened up before Daniel the dream and the various interpretations of each of those parts, the head of gold, breast of iron, sword, right down to the feet of iron and clay, Daniel must have said, the king is not going to want to hear this kind of interpretation. This is not the kind of message the king is going to want to hear. He's already as mad as a wild bull. His anger and fury is renowned across the world. And if I go in there and tell the king what God has told me to tell the king, then I can be quite certain my life will be sacrificed, and the lives of my three friends, and of course, all the lives of the wise men of Babylon who have been unable to give the interpretation to the king. Now, Daniel could have started to do some logical reasoning. Logical but false reasoning. He could have said, well, we've seen King Nebuchadnezzar over the past several years, and we know that he is the Antichrist. He is the Pope of the world. He is Babylon personified. And honestly, that man will never become a converted child of God. I mean, if you found yourself thinking about the present Pope, Pope John Paul, or maybe the ardent Roman Catholic priest that lives down in your town, and you thought in terms of that man being converted, what would you tend to do? Just smile rather scornfully, wouldn't you? That's such a prospect. Imagine it. And Daniel could have reasoned the same way. And Daniel could have said to himself, well, now look, It's very important that I and my three friends remain alive right here in the court of this king, because if we are removed, then where is the Church of God today, and where will the witness be given that needs to be given in this place? So Daniel could have said, now, all right then, so I'd better do a wise thing here. I know God has said to me, tell the king that's the interpretation. But I think that I'm wiser, I'm too wise to put my head out in a block, on a block like that. And so I'll invent an interpretation which instead will be just what the king wants to hear. I'll tell him his kingdom is this glorious golden kingdom, and the silver and the brass and the iron and the feet of iron and clay and all that are other inferior kingdoms, and he's the head of them all. And I just miss out the stone and the dust part. I won't talk about that. Now, could Daniel have reasoned in that fashion? Would that have been logical reasoning from the human point of view? Very much so. But would it have been false reasoning? Likewise, very much so. Now, there is a responsibility which rests upon the true people of God, and that responsibility is not to start making plans on God's behalf or to start figuring out the way in which the work of God should be carried forward. In the book Great Controversy, page 609, there is given to us a very clear directive about our responsibilities. It talks about the awful persecution which is to be generated in response to the giving of the loud cry and latter rain power. And it says, in regard to God's people, they are threatened with destruction. The enthusiasm which animated them is gone, yet they cannot turn back. Then, feeling their utter helplessness, they flee to the Mighty One for strength. They remember that the words which they had spoken were not theirs, but His who bade them give the warning. God put the truth into their hearts, and they could not forbear to proclaim it. The same trials have been experienced by men of God in the past, in ages past. Wycliffe, Huff, Luther, Tyndall, Baxter, Wesley declared that they would renounce everything, urged that all doctrines be brought to the test of the Bible, and declared that they would renounce everything which it condemned. Against these men, persecution raged with relentless fury. Yet they ceased not to declare the truth. Different periods in the history of the Church have each been marked by the development of some special truth adapted to the necessities of God's people at that time. Every new truth has made its way against hate and opposition. Those who were blessed with this light were tempted and tried. The Lord gives a special truth for the people in an emergency. Who dare refuse to publish it? He commands His servants to present the last invitation of mercy to the world. They cannot remain silent except at the peril of their souls. Now, I want your attention now as I read these next few words, because here is a guideline that we must forever keep in mind. It says, Christ's ambassadors have nothing to do with consequences. Right? Christ's ambassadors have nothing to do with consequences. They must perform their duty and leave results where? With God. Now, it was not for Daniel to concern himself about the consequences of telling the king what God had told him. God had told him what the dream was, therefore that was the dream. God had told him what the interpretation of the dream was, therefore that was the interpretation. And no matter how perilous might appear the task of telling the king what God told Daniel to tell the king, he must do it utterly and completely regardless of consequences. That was critically important. It was not for him to start reasoning and saying, well, if I do this, this is going to happen, so I better not do it because that's going to happen. You know, of course, that that's a tendency which we find that marks our pathway at times when we're called upon to proclaim the truth of God. We say, yes, but if I do it, that's going to happen, and that's going to happen, and that's going to happen. So I think I'll just be careful now and modify my actions to make sure some of these things don't take place. But not with Daniel. He went there before the king, determined to do only what God told him to do, regardless of the consequences. And you know something? When we do that, almost invariably, the bogeyman that Satan has built up before our minds, this great specter of disaster, just doesn't come to pass. And what we feared would be a dreadful loss and victory, instead become a loss and defeat, instead becomes a glorious victory as God works out his perfect plan. And so Daniel stands before the king, determined to tell the king only the truth, regardless of what the consequences may be. Now in verse 27, Daniel sums up before the king, and this really was a courageous thing for him to say. Daniel answered in the presence of the king and said, "The secret which the king has demanded, cannot the wise men, the astrologers, the magicians, the soothsayers show unto the king?" I've always been a little sorry the way this verse is written, because it's written like a question, but without a question mark. And it's really a statement, and should read as follows: "The secret which the king hath demanded, the wise men, the astrologers, the magicians, the soothsayers, cannot show unto the king." Now that was kind of rubbing in the salt, wasn't it? I mean, what had made the king angry before? This very fact. Now Daniel stands there, a despised Hebrew captive. He wasn't even a Babylonian. He represents another church or religion altogether. That religion which above all others Babylon fears and hates. And he tells the king, "King, your system doesn't work, does it?" Babylon has been exposed as being unable to meet every possible problem and solve every possible difficulty. Babylon has come to that point where her capacities have been breached, and we find inadequacy and failure in her system. Now then, was that the kind of thing that Nebuchadnezzar wanted to hear? Does he become angry? No, he doesn't. He listens with profound respect and the deepest interest. As Daniel now continues, Daniel now says, "But there is a God in heaven." There is a God in heaven that revealeth secrets and maketh known to the king Nebuchadnezzar what shall be in the latter days. Thy dream and the visions of thy head upon thy bed are these. Now then, Daniel now stands in a position from which he makes the most remarkable statements before that king. Statements which were based not upon the witness of sight and circumstances, but which were based upon the witness of the promises of God. Now, if we come back to our study of yesterday morning, which we talked about taking our minds, removing our minds, that's the word, removing our minds from the discouraging witness of sight and circumstances and fixing them upon the promises of God, here we have a remarkable Bible example of this being done in the case of Daniel. Now, as far as Daniel was concerned, the church of God in the court of Babylon numbered four souls, all young men, inexperienced, captives. They were not backed up by numbers or by armies, and they stood there, this insignificant and despised little company of four young men, in the presence of the mightiest king upon the earth. And they represented the best that God had and the best that God could do under those particular circumstances. It wasn't much of a witness for God, was it? Was it? No, it wasn't. On the other side, pitted against those four young men in direct battle array, was the king of Babylon, who only had to snap his fingers, indicate his finger, and off came a man's head. There was no trial, no courts, no witnesses, no judge. The king just spoke the word, and that was it. Off came the head of anybody who offended him. And the king was backed up by the greatest army upon the face of the earth, unspeakable riches, unlimited power. The whole world was at his footsteps. And so therefore, from the human point of view, did not this appear as if he was the one who could say, "There is a God in Babylon, and look what that God has done for Babylon"? So what courage and what faith it must have been for Daniel to stand there and say, "There is a God in heaven." Nebuchadnezzar, you can't see very much of his people. You can't see very much of his works. Here, my three friends and I number all of the church of God, all of those who are faithful to him within your court, within this palace, within this governmental center. But even though King Nebuchadnezzar, every witness of sight and circumstances says to me that there is no God in heaven, Nebuchadnezzar, I tell you by faith, there is a God in heaven. And were they words of courage and faith? Did they deny the formidable witness of sight and circumstances? Did Daniel move his mind away from that to the great promises and truth of God? Absolutely. Was he ignoring facts? No. He was seeing real facts, great realities, that revealed the presence of the Almighty God up in the kingdom of heaven. And even though today they numbered but four, Daniel knew that Nebuchadnezzar could not prevail against them, and that when in the end of all things the battle was finally drawn, it would be God's people who would survive the reign of Babylon, live beyond her ultimate ruin, and look up and see Jesus come in the clouds of heaven, that great stone that would fill the whole earth with power and glory and bring in a kingdom of everlasting might that would never, ever pass away. Now, something of this is brought to view in verse 28. For Daniel says, but there is a God in heaven that revealeth secrets and maketh known to the king Nebuchadnezzar what shall be in the latter days. Now they knew perfectly well what was there in those days. That was no secret. We can briefly recite the facts again right now. In those days, Babylon was a world empire. Babylon ruled the world. Babylon's success testified to the merit of man's way of doing things. Babylon's glory showed that man, by taking God's power and manipulating that power according to human planning, could build world empires of tremendous power and unbelievable wealth. And such kingdoms contained in them the appearance of permanency. After all, Nebuchadnezzar, as we said before, could say, I've conquered the world, I've conquered the church of God, I set a queen and am no widow, and shall come to no sorrow. The whole world is mine and shall be forever and forever. But Daniel said, King Nebuchadnezzar, God will show you what shall be in the latter days, and will not be what you think will be. And of course, as the revelation brought to view in the vision shows, the kingdom of Babylon would have a very short period of supremacy, a mere 70 years to be exact, which was a very, very short period. The Roman Empire, which came upon the scene later, lasted from 186 BC to 476 AD, which was something like 594. I think if my maths is quite correct there, about almost 6 centuries, whereas Babylon lasted barely more than 6 decades. So this great Babylon was not going to last very, very long at all, whereas Nebuchadnezzar thought in the latter days, it would still be there as a supreme power on this earth under heaven. So Daniel proceeds and says to the king, verse 29, as for thee, O king, thy thoughts came into thy mind upon thy bed, what should come to pass hereafter? And he that revealeth secrets maketh known to thee what shall come to pass. As for me, the secret is not revealed to me for any wisdom that I have more than any living, but for their sake that shall make known the interpretation to the king, and that thou mayest know the thoughts of thy heart. And come back for a moment then to verse 29. We find Daniel tells the king that this image or this vision would reveal to the king not only what should take place in the latter days, but what would take place hereafter. Now, what should take place hereafter? Here we have two areas. Let's just kind of sketch these up on the board today to show where we're going with this. The latter days, of course, are right down at the very end. Okay? Now, I want to make a point of this because in these two words, the latter days and the hereafter, we have summed up very neatly the two parts of the prophetic areas of Daniel. Now, first of all, we have a little portion back there which was history involving something like 70 maybe 90 years. And that was, at that point in time, we have the here to which Daniel referred. And he said, God will show you what shall take place hereafter. So here we have the hereafter period. And it also reveal what shall take place in the latter days. And the end of all things shall come to pass. Now when we get into the prophetic part of Daniel, we'll make this point quite strongly, that the prophetic part of Daniel
is actually describing a very unnecessary interval.
An interval which should never have been.
Because what took place in Daniel's day was a foreview, a preview of what shall take place in the final battle. Daniel's experience was a demonstration of the way in which the work will be finished. So here we have two periods which parallel each other. And the events which took place in Daniel's day are again to take place in the latter days, when again the final battle is drawn. And you recall last night how we demonstrated that just as in Jeremiah's day, a message went forth preparing the people, so at this very moment a message is coming to us from God preparing every one of us for that final struggle. We saw too just as how the Babylon ruled the world here, it'll rule the world here. Just as the apostate church of God was captive back there, so it'll be again down here at the end of time. Just as God chose a little company, unrecognized and unknown, so it'll be down here in the end of time as well. But in the meantime, in this interval between the days of Daniel and the joining of this last battle, we have an up and down struggle where the church is sometimes up and sometimes down, where there is delay and delay and delay when the work might have been finished but wasn't finished. And so it goes on right down till the end of time. Now later, of course, we'll come to Daniel 8 verses 13 and 14. In verse 13, a voice is heard asking a question, and the question is, how long shall be the vision concerning the daily to give both the sanctuary and the host of God underfoot? And the answer, unto 2,300 days. Then in Daniel 12 comes the question, how long to the end of these wonders? And the answer, 1260 days and 1290 days. 1290 days, of course, starting back at the time of the setting up of the daily and the abomination that make it desolate. Now, I do want to impress your minds very strongly with the fact that the book of Daniel reveals this terrible and unnecessary interval, this long protracted struggle, when the church of God could have been victorious, as Daniel was, if they had lived as Daniel lived back at that point of time. And when they failed to do that, of course, then they extended time right down to our present day, and it's now left with us, of course, to be God's instruments whereby the work can be very, very quickly finished. You know when in Romans the 8th chapter, or it's the 9th chapter, maybe 9:28, it says there that the Lord will finish the work and cut it short in righteousness, for a short work will the Lord make in the earth, make upon the earth. Now I used to understand this verse quite wrongly. I used to think that the day would come when God got a little impatient with this long delay and said, well, it's time. Let's just shake off this messing around and we'll get down there to the earth in mighty power and we'll take hold of the church of God. We'll shake them up, we'll stir them around and we'll send them out filled with the Spirit to do what they ought to have done long before. And so I always thought in terms of a special intervention on God's part to achieve what he hadn't done previously. And of course, in the back of my mind lurked an evil question. If God is going to do that in the end, well, why did he do it a couple of thousand or 4,000 years ago? Why wait so long before he gets upset with a long delay and then do it? But now I've come to understand that God could always have done a short work in the earth and would always have done a short work in the earth if only he'd had men like Daniel, Meshach, Shadrach, and Abednego to work with. God doesn't require a long time to wind up the sin problem. He doesn't need that. He's a perfect plan maker. He has all power in heaven and earth. What he doesn't have, or hasn't happened to this point, is a church full of faithful workers who, like Daniel, would never interpose their own plans in the place of God's plan. That's what God has never had. And until he gets it, the work will not be finished and cut short in righteousness. So when he does get that band of workers, then what? It will be cut short in righteousness, for a short work will the Lord make in the earth. Now what a challenge that brings to us at the present time. Never have I seen so plainly, so clearly, the secret for the finishing of the work. Never. Remember back in the Seventh Adventist Church, all the different ideas were cooked up to finish the work quickly. Remember one day a minister stood up and said, you know, that if you were to tell someone about the gospel and it took you 5 minutes to give a little nutshell gospel presentation, and that person would spend the next 5 minutes telling somebody else,
Well, each and every 5 minutes, those two continue telling somebody else. The fan effect of this spreading out would mean that everybody upon the face of the earth would be told the gospel in an incredibly short period of time. And that was put forward, and I've forgotten how short that time was, just a matter of a month, I think, or a couple of months. And this preacher was very enthusiastic. This was the grand answer. Because the place where it all fell down flat was, they didn't have the gospel to start with. So if they didn't have the gospel to start with, how can they tell others about the gospel they didn't even have? And of course, you can't preach the whole gospel in 5 minutes anyway. It takes more time than that. But all those various schemes to generate interest and to bring the message before the world, for radio, television, all the rest of it, are human schemes which will find no success. And I think that we have to recognize the Seventh-day Adventist Church is one of the most organized missionary bodies upon the face of the earth. So much so that they're a marvel to other church organizations, and justifiably so. And yet, over a century of their trying to do it their way, without success, should prove to us that we need to have another way. And the other way is revealed to us in the life of Daniel. And so let me say it again, the challenge before us today is this: will we again learn to live as Daniel did, as a band of people, so God at last will have that team of workmen he's been waiting 6,000 years to find? That's the challenge of today. If God will find those kind of people in you and me, then it's through us the work will be finished. If he doesn't find them, he'll keep looking, and he'll find them, and someone else will take the place we might have occupied, and that will be tragic. Tragic for us, and tragic in that once again there'll be an extensive delay before Jesus Christ can come and appear in the clouds of heaven. We now read on to verse 13. And as I said, keep this structure in mind here, because as we move on into the prophetic part, we'll be repeating that thought and demonstrating from the prophetic part the facts that I've shown you there on the blackboard today. Now verse 13, which says, "But as for me, the secret is not revealed to me for any wisdom that I have more than any living, but for their sakes it shall make known the interpretation to the king, and that thou mightest know the thoughts of thy heart." Now did King Nebuchadnezzar think that he knew the thoughts of his heart? No, certainly. He thought he understood what was going on. He thought he had a correct evaluation of history. He thought he knew the secret of success. After all, he was a very successful man. And was he not one of the best educated men upon the face of the earth? I mean, a man who sits as an examiner of other men in a university has to be a highly educated person. Now Daniel is telling the king, "Look, king, you think that you know. You're confident that you're wise. But king, O king, you are about to receive from God a revelation of the real truth that will vastly correct the thinking in your mind. And you will know, you will understand the real nature of the thoughts which are in thy heart." Now, were those words fulfilled? Sure they were. We already know the story, don't we? We've been over it before. And we know that down toward the end of this chapter, the king made a fantastic confession that the messages brought to him by God through Daniel were absolutely right and true and correct and proper. And he did gain an altogether different and fresh and new understanding of the real implications of political history. You know, I regret the fact that out there in the schools where history is taught, it's so wrongly taught. History is taught as a eulogy or an exaltation of man. There's this great general, that great statesman, this great poet, that great writer, that great musician, that great inventor, as the case may be. And the nations uphold these great men as being the representatives of their power and their greatness. Now, I note with interest, of course, that when you read an English history book, they give a very, very different representation of George Washington from what the American history books give of George Washington. A very different picture indeed, which shows how partisan and untruthful, how lacking in true objectivity the historians are. They're so nationalistic and so proud that they want to use men to exalt them as a nation. And that's why, of course, the Russians tried to beat the Americans to the moon through the Russian science and technology, was ahead of the American science and technology, and so forth. And of course, in the gymnastic sports, it's the same thrust to prove that one nation is superior to any other nation upon the earth. And so this whole thing was designed to give to King Nebuchadnezzar an accurate evaluation of the outworking of his system versus the outworking of God's system. And we too, remember, are the ones for whom this revelation was given, not only to change his thinking, but for our sake that shall make known the interpretation to the king. Wonderful indeed are the revelations of truth, which we shall see in our next study period in the image of Daniel 2, where there was given much more than simply a recital of coming nations, but rather the outworking of the principles of righteousness versus the principles of Babylon. Now, to stop at this point, we will come back to our theme again in our next study period and continue the story of the book of Daniel from the second chapter.